This week, we're very fortunate to have as our colloquium speaker Rachel Greenfeld from the Institute for Advanced Study. Rachel got her PhD from Bar-Ilan University in 2019, and then was a Hedrick Assistant Professor at UCLA, and recently has moved to being a member at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Rachel has recently written a important and already famous paper disproving the periodic tiling conjecture. And so she'll tell us about that terrific result today. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Just a second. Sure. Okay. I'm going to talk about our result, about the failure of the periodic tiling conjecture. But first, let me introduce the conjecture. And in order to introduce the conjecture, we need to talk about the structure of translational tiling. And in order to talk about the structure of translational tiling, we need to know what are translational tiling. So we start with definition. I should say, as written, this talk is based on our joint project with Terry Tao. So here is a definition. We start by defining translational tilings in the Euclidean space. So here I look at some bounded measurable set omega in RD. I want to know if there is a countable set T such that if I translate my set omega along the points of T, almost every point in the space is covered exactly once. If such a set T exists, then we say that omega is a tile of RD, and T, the translation set, is called a tiling of RD by omega. So T is the tiling. So this is the definition, and here we have some pictures that illustrate the notion, at least in two dimensions. And I want to turn your attention to the fact that in each of these examples, the translation set is a lattice, by which I mean a discrete subgroup of the space whose quotient is compact. So a full dimensional discrete subgroup. All these examples are also very rigid. So in the sense that we cannot slide anything. We cannot, if we slide one piece, we need to slide all the other in order for the tiling to be preserved. So here the structure is very rigid. And so this is the terminology that we are going to use. And the general question that I'm interested in is analyzing the structure of these tiling. Or if I use this orange notation for the set of all the tilings by omega, I want to understand how this set looks like. For example, if omega is a symmetric hexagon in the plane, then this set of tiling consists of only one lattice and all its cosets, all its translates. So in this case, we have a tiling that is unique up to translation. The structure is very, very rigid. However, when I wanted to tile my backyard with a rectangle, this was no longer the case because I had the freedom to slide the rows independently and get many, 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 many more structures. I can generalize this latter example and consider cube tilings in all dimensions. And cube tilings, you might consider them to be a naive example of tiling, but it turns out that these tiling can get very, very complicated to analyze as the dimension increases. And in order to illustrate this phenomenon, I'll introduce a question. So the question is, does any cube tiling contain two cubes that share a common facet? A facet is a d minus one dimensional face. So the picture here kind of hints that the answer should be positive, at least in two dimensions, right? And Keller conjectured in 1930 that the answer is positive in all dimensions. This is the famous Keller's conjecture, and it took more than 60 years until counterexamples to this conjecture were constructed in dimensions 8 and higher. This was done by using group theory and graph theory methods. The key to the solution of Keller's conjecture is the following theorem of Piron, which allows us to reduce the question into a question of a bounded subset of a certain lattice. So what Piron shows is that if there is a counterexample to Keller's conjecture in RD, then there must also be a counterexample T, which is 2ZD periodic, by which I mean that T is invariant under translations but by any point in the lattice 2ZD, and it is contained in this very specific lattice. So what Piron does, he discretizes the problem and bounds it. So now we have a question about a bounded subset of a certain lattice. And in particular, this shows, or this implies, that the question, the d-dimensional question for each d, is decidable. There is an algorithm that computes in finite time whether the d-dimensional Keller conjecture is true or not. Using this this reduction of Piron, there were a sequence of more reductions. The first reduction was into a question on some finite abelian groups. Then this was reformulated into a question about a certain property of a certain type of graphs that are known also as Keller's graphs. And eventually, using this reduction, counterexamples were constructed in dimensions 8 and higher. And the seven-dimensional case was resolved very recently in 2019 using the assistance of a computer. So the decidability here was actually very, very important. So this is Keller's conjecture. It is true in dimension 7 and below, and it fails in dimensions 8 and higher. And I should say that I almost didn't say anything about the study of and the fascinating study of Keller's conjecture, because this is not our main topic today. Okay, so this is Keller's conjecture. Let's go back and look again at our unit cube. So clearly, the unit cube tiles along the integer lattice, right? Tiles RD along the integer lattice. But also, as we all know, if we consider the system of exponential functions with integer frequencies, then this system forms an orthogonal basis for L2 of the cube, right? So we see that there is some connection, weird connection, between tiling by the cube and frequency set for an orthogonal base of exponential for the cube. Is this a coincidence? So it turns out that this is not a coincidence. It was proven that there is a complete identity between tilings by the cube and a frequency set that define orthogonal bases for the cube. This is very weird. Orthogonal bases for L2 of the cube, they are analytic object, and tilings, they are geometric object. And it turns out that there is a complete identity between the structure of these frequency sets and the tilings. In order to discuss this interesting phenomenon in its context, I need to define spectral sets. So again, I look at some bounded measurable set omega in RD, and now I want to know if there is a frequency set lambda in RD such that the system of exponentials that it defines constitute an orthogonal basis or L2 of omega. If such a frequency set lambda exists, then we say that omega is a spectral set, and we call lambda a spectrum for omega. So what would be a classical example of a spectral set? Hint, we have seen it. So if you consider omega to be the unit cube, then it admits an orthogonal basis of exponential where the frequencies are just integers, right? And this is the classical Fourier analysis. This is a Fourier analysis on the torus. So we have the famous Parseval theorem and the famous Fourier expansion with coefficients that we can compute. We have a formula to compute this coefficient. And it turns out that all these nice properties, all these nice Fourier analysis that we know how to do on the torus or on the cube applies to L2 of omega whenever omega is spectral, because it all relies on the fact that the unit cube admits an orthogonal base of exponential. So whenever we have a set that admits such a basis, all what we know about the torus applies to its Hilbert space. So this is a very strong property of a set being spectral. And the natural question to ask is, who are these nice spectral sets? And Fugledek conjectured that these spectral sets, they are exactly the ones that tile the space by translation. So again, this fits with the phenomenon that we observe in the cube case. Fugledek conjectured that there is a very deep and strong connection between the analytic property of spectrality and the geometric property of tiling by translation. To support his conjecture, Fugledek proves some positive result towards it. The first result is easy. This is just an easy consequence of the Poisson summation formula. So he proves that if lambda is a lattice, then omega tiles along lambda if and only if the dual lattice is a spectrum for omega. He also proved that balls and triangles, they are not spectral. And of course that they cannot tile by translation. So we get another positive result towards the conjecture. Now, this conjecture, which is very interesting, motivated many researchers from many different areas to look into this weird connection between these two properties. And there have been obtained many positive results over the year using methods from many different areas, of course, Fourier analysis, geometry, but also combinatorics, and number theory, and group theory, and other fields. I will not be able to mention all the results that have been obtained, but I will just mention a few to give you some flavor. So Isabella Labo proved in 2000 that the conjecture holds for a union of two intervals on the line, yes?
Can you tell me how tile of capital omega RD is formally defined again?
It's just, let me write it here. So this is the set. Omega is a bounded measurable set in RD, bounded and measurable. This set is the set of all the tilings by omega. So all the sets such that if we translate omega along the points in this set, almost every point in RD is covered exactly once.
I'm always confused.
Okay. So these are all the tilings by omega.
Also, when we say that lambda star is a spectrum for omega, you mean By spectrum, we mean that are we looking at the harmonic operator in at omega and looking at the eigenvalues, or what do we mean by spectrum? Like, when you
let me. Yeah. So the spectrum of for omega is a frequency set, lambda, such that if we consider this system of exponential that it defines, so this system is the system of all the exponential functions with frequencies in lambda. This system of functions is an orthogonal base for L2 of omega. This is a spectrum. Okay, more questions? Yes.
With general omega, you're not going to get unique lambdas, right?
So the question is, what do you mean by uniqueness? Because this property of being a spectrum is invariant under translation. So once you have one spectrum, you have many, 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 many more spectra, because all its translate will also be spectra. But sometimes you do have uniqueness up to translation.
Yeah,
well,
I'm saying that up to translation, of course.
Yeah, not necessarily. For example, here is an example. I told you that for the cube, a set is a spectrum if and only if it is a tiling by the cube. Now, think about the cube tiling in two dimensions, right? I can start with Z2, with the integer lattice, the two-dimensional integer lattice, but I can slide one row, and this will no longer be a translate of the original lattice. It is still a tiling, and therefore it will be also a spectrum, because I told you that there is a complete identity between spectra and tiling set for the cube. So sometimes it's very similar to what happens in the tiling. Sometimes they are rigid, like with the symmetric hexagon. We had uniqueness up to translations, but sometimes they are not. And this is an interesting question to analyze the structure of the spectrum. Thank you. Okay, so Isabella Labo proved that the conjecture holds for a union of two intervals on the line. And the conjecture was also proven to hold for convex domains. This is due to Yosevich, Katz, and Tao, who proved the two-dimensional case. Then we developed tools to analyze the higher dimensional case. We completed the 3D case and made progress on the higher dimensional case, which was completed in a subsequent paper. So Fuglede's conjecture known to hold for many cases. However, 30 years after the conjecture was posed, counterexamples were first constructed by Terry Tao. So Terry constructed the first class of counterexample spectra sets in dimensions 5 and higher, which are spectral, but they do not tile by translation. Later, people adapted his approach, and as of today, we know that both directions of the conjecture fail in dimensions 3 and higher. Now, I want to emphasize at this point to say something about the nature of these counterexamples. All of them originate in finite abelian groups. So when we lift them, so you start with a finite abelian group, you find their counterexample, then you pull it back to be a counterexample to the conjecture in ZD, and then you inflate it to be a counterexample in RD. So we end up with a counterexample that all look like finite unions of unit cubes with centers at the integer lattice because of this nature of the construction. So all the known counterexamples, they look like a finite union of unit cubes with center at the integer lattice. In particular, they are disconnected. We don't know if the conjecture holds for connected sets. We don't have any counterexample yet. And just to complete the picture, I should say that both directions of the conjecture are completely open in dimensions 1 and 2. So this is Fugledo's conjecture. We have seen Keller's conjecture and Fugledo's conjecture. I should say that I almost didn't say anything about the study of this conjecture, because this is not the main topic of this talk. But the purpose of mentioning them here is just to motivate our study of the structure of translational time. And in this context, I want to maybe to emphasize two conclusions of the study of these two conjectures. One is that both Keller's conjecture and Fugledo's conjecture, they fail in high dimensions. So these kinds of demonstrate that the higher the dimension is, the worse the structure of the tiling can get. So this is the first takeaway. And the other takeaway that I want to emphasize is that both Keller's conjecture and Fugledo's conjecture were solved in the discrete setup. Okay? So equipped with these takeaways, let's go back to our original question. We want to understand the structure of tilings. And hopefully, at this point already, you got the feel that this is a highly non-trivial problem. Perhaps the most well-known conjecture in this context is the periodic tiling conjecture, which asserts that if omega tiles are d by translation, then it must admit at least one tiling which is periodic, namely it is invariant under translation by points of some lattice. This conjecture was implicitly posed in 87 by Greenbaum and Sheffard in their book. And later in 96, it was explicitly formulated in a paper by Lagarias and Wang. So let's see what we can say about this conjecture. So first, it was proven independently by Venkov and later by McMullen that the conjecture holds for convex domains in all dimensions. And this was done using geometry tools. Also, the conjecture is known to hold in the one-dimensional case. This was proven by Lagarias and Wang using Fourier analysis methods. And in R2, we know that the conjecture holds for topological disks. But in general, it's still open in R2. And this was proven by Bocquier and Nivat, and then later Kenyon removed some boundary condition that they had in their result, and together they proved this statement, and they did it using geometry and topology tools.
Can I ask about the middle, so Lagarias and Wang results? What sense is every tiling in R periodic? I don't quite understand that. What about a quasi-periodic tiling by two tiles of two different lengths or something? Why is that not so?
Yeah. So if you have two different tiles, so the thing is that we have just one tile here, and this is what we talked about in the morning. So this what makes tilings very rigid. The fact that we tile by only a single tile and only by translation. Otherwise, you can very easily find counterexamples. Okay. Very, very, very recently, Terry and I were able to construct counterexamples to the conjecture in sufficiently high dimensions. So we proved by an explicit construction that we will discuss today that the conjecture fails in dimensions, in high dimensions. So this fits with the general phenomenon that we discussed before. The higher the dimension is, the worse the structure can get, and things that we expected to be true we kind of lose our expectation. And we lose our intuition maybe. about a sufficiently large part of the statement, this can actually be computed. And so the construction is very, very explicit. And we can compute a bound on the sufficiently large, but we didn't do it because it's not interesting in the sense that it is very, 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 very far from what we believe to be optimal. And in particular, the two-dimensional case is still open. As we observed in the example of Kellen's conjecture and Fuglede's conjecture, also our construction is done in the discrete world. So in order to discuss the construction, I need to define tilings in the discrete setup. So here is the definition. Now our world is ZD. This is the group that we tile. And here a tile is a finite subset of ZD such that the space ZD can be partitioned into translated copies of this finite set F. Okay, this is a tile. And as when we can also adapt this the previous notation to denote all the tilings of ZD by F. Okay, so this is the set of all the translation sets by which F tiles ZD. So this is the definition, and this is the terminology that we are going to use. Let's try to digest it with some examples. The first example is easy. Now my set F is just a singleton, is a set of one element, and I want to tile ZD by this singleton. I can do it, right? Because if I translate this singleton along all the points in the group, then every point in the group is covered exactly once. I have a tiling. And in fact, in this case is so rigid, this is in fact the only possible tiling by a singleton. You don't have any other tiling. So this is an easy example. Let's see another example. Now my set F is a subset of Z, a set of two elements, 0 and 2. And I want to tile the integers with this set. So let's see what we can do. I'll put one copy at 0, another copy at 1, 4, 5, 8, 9. And you can already see the pattern. I can continue like this periodically and show that this green set solves this tiling equation. So this green set is a tiling by this set of two elements. Okay? So in the previous example, we had a tiling along a lattice, right? The tiling set was ZD, it is a lattice. Now we have a tiling which is not a lattice, right? It's a union of two cosets of the lattice for Z. Yet it is periodic. It's invariant under translations by the vector 4. So we have periodicity, although we don't have a lattice tiling. So far, we have just seen examples of sets that do tile. Of course, that this is not the case in general. There are many sets that do not tile. For example, if I want to tile the integers by this subset of cardinality 3, the set of the points 0, 1, and 3, this is impossible because, for example, there is no way to cover the point 2 without overlapping. Okay? So these are tilings in ZD. And as in the continuous setup, also here we can formulate the discrete periodic tiling conjecture, which suggests that if F is a tile of ZD, then it must admit at least one tiling that is periodic. Why do we care about this conjecture? So one reason is a reason that I already kind of hinted. It turns out that if we found a counterexample to this conjecture, then we immediately get the failure of the periodic tiling conjecture in the continuous setup in the same dimension. If we found a counterexample in ZD, we get immediately a counterexample in RD. So let me show you the proof of this statement. How do we inflate a counterexample in ZD to be a counterexample in RD? The proof is easy. So of course, that if I have a tiling in ZD, I can inflate it to be a tiling of RD if I just replace any point of the tile F by a unit cube that is centered at this point. Problem is that here I must get in the continuous setup, there are more degrees of freedom, and I might get some tilings here in this set that do not correspond to what I had in the discrete setup, because I might be able to slide things which I was not able to do in the discrete world. So to prevent this situation, instead of taking here naively the unit cube, I'll take some region fundamental domain of the torus of RD mod ZD. And by doing that, I can no longer slide anything. And all the tilings that I get in the continuous setup, they correspond to tiling that I had in the discrete setup up to translations. But well, translation, they don't change the periodicity. So we are fine. That's how we actually just proved that the continuous periodic tiling conjecture implies the discrete periodic tiling conjecture, right? Any questions? Or in other words, if we have the failure, if we can prove the failure of the discrete periodic tiling conjecture, we get immediately the failure. We can inflate the counterexample to be a counterexample to the continuous periodic tiling conjecture in the same dimension. I want to mention here another result which is related. So a related construction shows that the periodic tiling conjecture in ZD implies the periodic tiling conjecture in any quotient of ZD. This was proven recently by Mayorovich, Sanadia, and Solomon. And I mention it because we are going to use this result. So again, we want to lift a counterexample from this group to be a counterexample in ZD. What we will do, we'll choose some fundamental domain. And this way, all the tilings that we get in the pullback construction correspond to what we had in the projection. Okay, so this is one reason why we might be interested to study the discrete periodic tiling conjecture, the connection to the continuous periodic tiling conjecture. And another reason or another example of the importance of the discrete periodic tiling conjecture is its connection to decidability, or the question whether there exists an algorithm which computes in finite time, given any finite subset of ZD, it computes in finite time whether this finite subset is a tile of ZD or not. So it turns out that if we have if the periodic tiling conjecture is true, then such an algorithm exists. And this was proven by Han Wang in 1961, and we discussed this the proof this morning. So here I'll just say that we have this implication. So one example of the importance of the discrete periodic tiling conjecture is its connection to this decidability question, the decidability of tilings. And as we have observed in the case of Keller's conjecture, this decidability, the ability to compute tilings to use a computer to analyze the structure of tiling, can be very useful to the study. Okay, there are many good reasons to study the discrete periodic tiling conjecture, and there are also many tools to study this conjecture. So let me mention some of them here. This is a geometric question, so we can naively try to attack it using geometry tools. But we can also, as we have observed in Keller's conjecture, tiling questions, they can be interpreted as graph theory questions or coloring questions, and then we can use combinatorics to study the structure of tilings. You can also try to use Fourier analysis, as people have done a lot recently, because this tiling equation, we can rewrite it as this convolution equation, as we discussed this morning. And when a Fourier analyst sees a convolution, what we immediately do, we apply the Fourier transform to it. And this will give us this product equation in frequency space. And the thing is that these two equations, they are equivalent by the uniqueness of the Fourier transform. So instead of studying this convolution in physical space, we can study this product equation in frequency space, or in other words, the distribution 1 sub a hat in the zero set of the trigonometric polynomial 1 sub f hat. And whatever conclusion we had in frequency space, we can then transfer back to physical space and conclude about the structure of the tiling, again, by the uniqueness of your Fourier transform. So we can use Fourier analysis. We can also use ergodic theory, because when we equip this tiling space with an ergodic measure, we get an ergodic point process. And we can try to use spectral analysis to study the spectral measure of this point process. Also, number theory tools and probabilistic method have been found useful to the study of the structure of tilings. And as we discussed, there is some connection between decidability and periodicity. So we can try to use model theory or computability theory to study either the logical decidability or the algorithmic decidability, and maybe deduce about the periodicity. So there are many tools to study this conjecture. And let me mention some of the results that are known. So we know that the periodic tiling conjecture, the discrete periodic tiling conjecture, holds in the one-dimensional case. This is easy. This is just an easy consequence of the pigeonhole principle. The 2D case is already quite complicated. But quite recently, it was proven by Bhattacharya using ergodic theory and spectral analysis methods. And a bit later, Terry and I, we suggested an alternative proof for this result, which relies only on elementary combinatorics. What's known in high dimensions? Well, not a lot. Szegedy proved in 98 that the conjecture holds for tiles with a prime cardinality or cardinality that is equal to 4. But he did it by using combinatorics and number theory tools. But of course, that there are many more tiles. And indeed, as I kind of spoiled it before, recently Terry and I were able to find to construct explicitly counterexamples to the discrete periodic tiling conjecture in sufficiently high dimensions. And this, as we have seen, proves the failure of the continuous periodic tiling conjecture as well. As I told you before, D in our construction is going to be very, 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 very large. However, in fact, our construction is not done directly in ZD. We actually make our construction first in Z2 cross some finite abelian group. So in a space that is almost two-dimensional. It is virtually Z2. And this, so we don't use in our construction the full complexity of ZD. We construct it in this space, which is virtually Z2, and then pull it back by using the argument of Sanadia, Meyerowitz-Sanadia and Solomon, to be an example, a counterexample, or a periodic tiling in ZD. So since we construct the example in a space which is almost two-dimensional, this kind of hint that the conjecture should fail in quite early in terms of the dimension. Okay, so the rest of the talk will be devoted to the proof or the proof of this result, or how do we make our construction. So our construction is made by introducing some aperiodic Sudoku puzzle. Yeah.
Is it too early to say what's the smallest G0 you find for which you can do your construction? You can't do it for any G0. Does G0 have to be huge, or?
Yeah, G0 is going to be very huge. In particular, it's going to have many generators, and then that is why when we pull it back, D is enormous. It's very, very, very big. It's very far from being optimal. And after I discuss the proof, if you remind me, maybe I'll forget. If I don't forget, I'll answer your question. But after I introduce the proof, I'll be able to talk about why do we need so many generators, why G naught in our construction is very complicated. More questions? Yes.
So that means that given a bounded measurement, so given a set, you can the fact that there exists a tiling is undecidable, right? Because if it is decidable, then
not exactly, because what we proved, or we proved this morning, that if we have a periodicity, if the periodic tiling conjecture is true, then we have decidability. But we don't have the converse.
Yes.
So if we have aperiodicity, this does not necessarily imply undecidability. We need to work a bit harder to get undecidability, and we actually, this is something that we currently do, try to prove undecidability, but it does not follow. Maybe heuristically, if you have an aperiodic tiling, we expect the undecidability to be proven. We expect also undecidability, but it does not follow immediately. Okay, more questions. Let's talk about our proof or our construction. Maybe I'll use. Okay. So, so the proof is done by introducing a Sudoku puzzle that's aperiodic. And before I talk about our aperiodic puzzle, let me remind you, if anybody forgot, what is a standard Sudoku puzzle. So a standard Sudoku puzzle is a function on a 9 by 9 square, such that each row in this, when we restrict the function to each row or each column or each such a 3 by 3 block, what we get is a permutation, right? Okay. Now, our Sudoku is a bit different. The board now will be infinite. So this is my board. It has infinite height. So the height is Z. And it has width Q squared, where Q is some power of Q. Whenever, from now on, whenever I say Q, I refer to some large power of 2. So in all the examples that you are going to see, Q is equal to 4 because of the limitation of the size of my slides. But in reality, this power S is going to be something like 10. So it's going to be a bit misleading, but still it's useful to have these pictures that just to illustrate the notions or the ideas. So in all the pictures, Q is equal to 4. So we have this board. Can you see it? Yeah. And as in the standard Sudoku, also here we impose some constraints on any line of an integer slope inside this Sudoku. Okay, so we impose some structural constraint on any line of integer slope, and we restrict this function on this board on any line. We wanted to obey some quadratic structure, which I will discuss later. And with these constraints that we impose on our Sudoku solution, we are able to show that all the solutions are non-periodic. So we show that there is a solution, but none of the solutions is periodic. So we have an aperiodic puzzle, a puzzle that admits solutions, but none of the solutions is periodic. All the functions are non-periodic. Okay? So now we have an aperiodic puzzle. That's nice, but how is this connection connected to tilings? So the next step, step two, is to encode this aperiodic puzzle as a tiling equation. So since the tiling equation encodes the aperiodic puzzle, it must also admit just non-periodic solutions. So all the solutions to this tiling equation are going to correspond to solutions to our Sudoku. And since all the solutions here are non-periodic, also our tiling equation is aperiodic. Okay, so this is the general, maybe very rough sketch of the proof. So we need to discuss two steps here. Step one is constructing an aperiodic Sudoku puzzle, and step two is encoding it as a tiling equation. Let's start with step one, unless you have questions. Okay, so our Sudoku, maybe the key ingredients for the construction of the Sudoku is the following function fq. Again, q is a large power of two. What it does, fq is a function on the integers. It takes an integer n and returns the last non-zero digit in the base q expansion of the number n. And if such a number does not exist, if n is equal to zero, then we set the function to be equal to one. Okay? Or very explicitly, we take the number n, we divide it by the larger power of q that divides n, and mod q. Okay? So let's see an illustration of the behavior of q where q is equal to four. So what happens here? We have some kind of an almost periodic behavior in the sense that in every scale of Q, we have periodicity except for one bad coset, right? So we have these white cells. They are periodic, right? We have periodic behavior on the white cells, but then there is this gray coset that breaks down the periodicity, that ruins the periodicity. So we try to look into this gray, bad gray coset and see maybe we can fix this behavior. Maybe inside this gray coset we can find a period and this will fix the problem. But then there is one coset of q squared z, this red coset, that breaks down the periodicity again. And this happens in every scale q to the j of q. So we end up with a function that is very structured, but is non-periodic, because in every scale of q, there is one coset that breaks down the periodicity. Any questions? Okay, so we have this function fq, and we use it to define a class of functions, a class of sequences of lengths q squared. which correspond all the sequences of length q squared that correspond to some rescaled version of fq. Okay, let's see some examples of functions or sequences in our class sq. So this is one example of a sequence in our class, and this example is kind of still behave similarly to the behavior of FQ. In particular, the gray cells, they have a density 1/4. Okay? This is also a sequence in our class. And this sequence already not very similar to what we had in FQ. In particular, the gray cells, they have density 1/2. This is another example of a sequence in our class, and this sequence does not have any gray cells, and it is constant. And this is another example of a function in our class that is not constant and does not have any gray cells. So we can find many, many, many objects inside our class SQ. Some will be more similar to the behavior of the original function FQ. Some will be less similar. And using this class, we can finally define our Sudoku solution, our SQ Sudoku solution, to be a function on this board, such that every line of integer slope, every such line, is an element of SQ, of our class.
Sorry to have you repeat. Could you say again, when you say a function in our class means what?
SQ. This is a class of sequences, or a class of functions that correspond, that you can write in this form. They correspond to some rescaled version of FQ. So this is, for example, all the examples that we have seen, they are with Q that's equal to 4. Now the scaling factors A will be equal to 2 and B will be equal to 1. And this will give you this sequence. None of these numbers is divisible by 4, so we don't have any gray cells. Okay, so now we define an SQ Sudoku solution to be a function on our board, such that every line of integer slope inside this function corresponds or it belongs to the class SQ that we define. Okay, so here is one example of an SQ Sudoku solution. This is an example that we call it a standard Sudoku solution, because each column is just a copy of the original function FQ, right? So we just put copies of the original function FQ one next to another, and we get a solution. Now, I want to turn your attention to the fact that this function is not periodic, because each column is non-periodic. So we have a non-periodic function. Here is another example of an SQ Sudoku solution. Now we don't have the standard behavior. The columns, they are just shifted versions of the original function FQ. Yet we have non-periodicity, because each column is as a shifted version of a non-periodic function is non-periodic. Yeah.
Sorry, so by non-periodic, you mean by periodic, sorry. On the other hand, you mean that the lattice that acts on a particular tiling has to be the same dimension as the lattice itself?
Yes, yeah.
So like you're not counting just something aperiodic and then I just translate.
Right, right. In this case, we have actually one, it suffices since we have the board is kind of one dimensional, right? Because we have infinite height, but we have finite width. We actually have, if we have that, the non-periodicity of the columns will imply, or even just one of the columns, if we have just that one of the columns is non-periodic, we get the non-periodicity of the solution. Okay. The function is periodic if there is a lattice. A lattice is such that this quotient is compact. So we have a full dimensional discrete subgroup such that a function f is periodic if we have that there exists some lattice such that this equation is true for every point in the lattice. Okay? So this is periodicity for me. So we have seen so far two solutions that are non-periodic. This is promising because we want a puzzle that admits only non-periodic solution. Problem is that this is also an SQ Sudoku solution, right? Because all the lines of integer slope, they correspond to the constant element of SQ.
What is the range of Q in your definition?
So Q is a power of 2, and the power is going to be something like 10. In the pictures, Q is very small because I wanted to be able to draw some picture that will fit to the side of the size of the slide. But in reality, Q is going to be something like 2 to the 10. Okay? So here is a Sudoku solution. Every line of integer slope corresponds to an element of SQ. This is a problem because it is periodic, it is constant. So we want to exclude these nice solutions. In order to do it, we will add another constraint on our Sudoku. So not only the lines of integer slope, they belong to SQ, but also we want that each column is almost a periodized permutation. So for each column, there exists some permutation on Z mod Q, such that this equation is satisfied for every whenever the right hand side is not equal to 0. Okay, so you can see we have an almost a periodized permutation up to one coset where the permutation takes the value 0. With these two conditions, we are able to show that this puzzle admits only non-periodic solution. And of course, that it admits solution. Here is, for example, one of them. Here is another example of a solution. And all the solutions will be non-periodic. We show that any solution that satisfies these two conditions must be non-periodic. The columns must behave in a similar way to the behavior of FQ, which is non-periodic. Okay, so so far we have constructed an aperiodic Sudoku puzzle. Now we want to encode it as a tiling. Okay, this is step 2. We develop a tiling language by which we encode certain first order sentences into tiling equations. So let me show you some examples of tiling encoding. So G naught is going to be some finite abelian group. And I want to say the sentence A, the set A, is a graph of some function from Z2 to G naught. Okay? Instead, I can say that A solves this tiling equation where we have a vertical tile. This is the tile. And it tiles the whole group. So saying that A is a graph of a function from Z2 to G naught is the same as saying that A is a tiling by this vertical tile. Let's see why. Maybe I'll try to draw a picture also. So what do we have here? We have, G naught, I'll identify it with some shape, let's say this square, and Where is the and so this is our space. So we have something like this. This is Z2. And every point in Z2, since we are in this Cartesian product space, is equipped with a copy of G0. That's ours, that this is maybe an abstract picture of our space. And our tile, the tile, looks like this, the vertical tile, right? So let's see what happens. If I put two points of A in one square in my space, I'll have overlaps, right? So I cannot do it. If I don't put any point in one square, then this square will not be covered. So this means that I must have in each such square, I must put exactly one point of A, and only then I get a tiling. And what we encoded here is the vertical line test, right? Every vertical line takes just one value, and we have a function. This means that we have a graph of some function. So this is exactly what's written here, saying that A solves the tiling equation is the same as saying that for every point in Z2, this X slice of A solves this tiling equation. But this tiling equation just means that AX, the slice, is exactly a singleton. And this is the vertical line test. Any questions? So let's see another example of tiling encoding. Now G0 is going to be a cyclic group of order n. And I want to say the sentence, A is the graph of some function from Z to this G0, where the function f also satisfies this condition, which is the same as we said before, being a periodized permutation. So there exists a permutation on Z mod n, such that this equation is true for every x in the domain. So it turns out that this is the same as saying that A solves this system of tiling equations. The first equation, here we just have a vertical line. So the first equation just encodes that A is a graph of some function from Z to G0, as we proved before. And the second equation is equivalent to this condition being satisfied to every x in the domain. And this just means that there exists a permutation such that the graph that the function that our graph encodes satisfies this equation. Here we have a, I just want to turn your attention, here we have a horizontal tile. Do you want me to draw the picture of this encoding, or do you see the picture?
You can draw it.
I can draw it. Let's draw a picture. So now we have the first equation is the equation that we already encoded. So we know that A is a graph of some function from Z to G0, but this graph also satisfies the second equation. Let's see what the second equation means. So, when did we start? Maybe you'll tell me.
Well, we're about 10 minutes over. We're the hypothetical ending time. So
okay.
Great to, if there's some graph that's relative.
Okay. So let's Okay, so maybe afterwards I can.
Yeah, there's going to be coffee afterwards.
Okay, so we see that we can encode certain first order sentences into a system of tiling equation, and the key is that every system of tiling equation can be encoded as just a single tiling equation if we just enlarge the group by a cyclic group. So we will take the equations that we had in the system, we will stack them using the additional dimension, and then we'll get one equation in a larger group. So using these techniques, we can now encode a collection of sentences or paragraphs into just one single tiling equation. And using this, we can encode finally our aperiodic puzzle. So if I denote by Gn the nth column of the function on the board, I need to encode two sentences with respect to it. One is that it yields this set of columns yield a S Sudoku solution, an SQ Sudoku solution, but this is not enough because then we still can have periodic solution. So we need to add the second constraint, which is every GN is an almost periodized permutation. And with our language, we can encode these two sentences into a system of tiling equation in Z2 cross some finite abelian group. This system of tiling equation can be encoded as just one tiling equation if we just add one cyclic group. And this latter equation, it encodes being a good SQ Sudoku solution, and therefore it must be aperiodic because the puzzle is aperiodic. So this is a high-level picture of the proof. The blue part is what we called step one. We introduced a Sudoku puzzle, we prove that it's aperiodic. Simultaneously, we develop a language by which we can encode this Sudoku as a system of tiling equation. By combining the blue with the yellow, we get this green conclusion that we have a system of tiling equation that is aperiodic in Z2 cross some finite abelian group. This system can be encoded as just a single tiling equation if we enlarge the group by just a cyclic group. We pull it back to be a construction, an aperiodic tiling in ZD using the argument of Meyerowitz, Sanadia, and Solomon, and then we inflate it to be an aperiodic tiling in RD. So this is the picture of the proof. This is in Word. We construct a counterexample in Z2 coarse G-node. We pull it back to ZD, and we inflate it to be a counterexample in RD. Do we have time to discuss some open problem?
Yeah, maybe a few minutes, yes.
Okay, so what's next? First question that is interesting and we are currently looking into, what is, we know that the periodic tiling conjecture fails at some point. What is the optimal D? What is the dimension in which the conjectures start to fail? So this is the way, and we can ask the question in ZD, we can ask it also in RD. Also, I told you that the continuous periodic tiling conjecture implies the discrete one, but what about the converse? So the converse is known in one dimension, this was proven by Lagares and Wang, but in dimensions two and higher, this is not clear. And if we were able to prove that the discrete periodic tiling conjecture implies the continuous one, even in dimension two, we will get immediately the periodic tiling conjecture in R2, because in Z2, we know that it holds, in R2 it's still open. Also, as you asked, the decidability is still open. We found an aperiodic construction, but maybe there are non-undecidable tiling problems. So we try to construct one using our encoding. Also, our construction of a counterexample to the periodic tiling conjecture is highly disconnected. So maybe the periodic tiling conjecture holds for connected set. Maybe we can find a counterexample. So this is still open. it's also not known whether there is any aperiodic tile that is also spectral. Maybe all the, now that we know that the aperiodic tiles exist, maybe all of them are not spectral. Maybe all of them provide counterexample to Fugleda's conjecture. And then we have a new class of construction. And maybe the most interesting problem is to try to see if the tools that we have developed to study the periodic tiling conjecture can help us to better understand other tiling related problems that are still open. For example, Nivat's conjecture in symbolic dynamics about the structure of subsheets in Z2 with low pattern complexity, or the Koven-Meyerowicz conjecture, which tries to classify one-dimensional tiles using some number theory criteria. So that's it. Thank you.
All right, thank you for that wonderful, really great. And I apologize for rushing it at the end because it was really beautiful proof. So are there any questions?
By inflating from ZD to RD, do you mean by dilation theorem? What do you exactly mean by?
Yeah, so you ask about how do we inflate a counterexample from ZD to RD. So this is this proof that we discussed here. We use this rigid, that's the proof. So we use, we have a counterexample in ZD. We replace every point in this tile that admits only non-periodic tilings, we replace it with, you can think about it, I called it a rigid fundamental domain, but you can have in mind, as you have here in the picture, some kind of a piece of a jigsaw puzzle. Okay? It does not allow you to slide anything. So you replace it with a piece of jigsaw puzzle that is centered at this point of F. And then you get a tiling of RD by doing that, right? And this tiling, you cannot slide it. It's like the example that we had with the symmetric hexagon. If you slide one piece, you need to slide all the other pieces. Otherwise, the tiling will not be preserved. So all the tilings in the continuous setup, they correspond to tilings in the discrete setup because you cannot take advantage of the opportunity to slide in RD. So all of these tilings, they correspond to discrete tilings. And since here in the discrete setup, we don't have any periodic tiling, and also here in RD, we don't have any periodic tiling, because all the tilings here, they come from here. So that's how we inflate. We need some piece of a jigsaw puzzle to inflate the construction.
Can you do something similar to the proof that you explained, but in order to find a counterexample in just set one dimension instead of set two times the finite group, like just 1D?
So in 1D, so you say Z cross finite abelian group? So we can actually prove that the periodic tiling conjecture holds in Z cross a finite abelian group. We proved it in a previous paper. So we won't be able to find a counterexample. Good question, thank you. Yes?
How do you exactly, like on a very general level, how do you exactly encode the decidability problem as a Turing machine? Like how do you kind of, like, if you want to encode that problem, so would you consider every, what's going to be the set that you want to compute?
Exactly. So we talked a bit about it in the morning. I told you that we have a construction with two tiles. So the question is about the decidability. What is the undecidable problem that we are going to encode in order to get the undecidability of tilings, right? So in the morning, I told you that In a previous paper, we constructed an undecidable tiling problem with two tiles. And we did it by encoding the Wang tiling problem, or tilings by multiple tiles in Z2 as a tiling problem by only two tiles in Z2 cross G0. The thing is that we were not able to encode Wang tilings or tilings by multiple tiles in Z2 as a tiling problem with only single tile. That is why we needed to come up with this Sudoku approach. We needed a new puzzle that is expressible in our language as a tiling equation with just a single tile. With Wang tiles or tiling by multiple tiles, we needed an additional tile to help us in the encoding. So now maybe I cannot say yet what is going to be the problem because it's still a work in progress. But roughly speaking, we think that since our construction, we use just two dimensions to construct it, maybe we can gain some complication if we consider some kind of Sudoku puzzle with more than, which are not two-dimensional, but in high dimensions. And that is how we will get the complexity. Maybe by using that, we'll be able to encode Wang tilings that are undecidable or, but this is still a work in progress. I mean, we don't have a result yet.
I'm worried that this is going to be a long question. I mean, it's a long answer, in which case, if it is, maybe we'll just kill the question. But
we can talk to you over coffee.
I'm just curious. I just feel like it would be interesting to hear. So the whole construction of the Sudoku puzzle, the idea of doing it seems like a very clever idea, like a bit of a bolt from the blue. Is it easy to say where the idea for that comes from?
Great question. I say, but I felt that you don't have time. We also started late. So I want to say something. Thank you. So I'll say something about it, which is, I think maybe it's the most fascinating lesson that I can give you. This usually happens when you do research, at least for I don't have a long experience, but at least for my experience. So what happened was that our original goal was to prove the periodic tiling conjecture in Z3. So there was this paper of Bhattacharya. When I came to UCLA, Terry gave me that paper and he said, let's do this Z3 case. And we looked into that paper and it was really hard. Then we came up with this alternative proof that we could work with. And we had this alternative proof for the Z2 case. And we thought, let's try now to prove the Z3 case using this more informative proof. And we encountered many, 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 many obstacles. And at that point, I started to think, I prepared some talk, and then when you prepare a talk, you start to read around the problem, and I found some very nice construction of a curry of an aperiodic tiling in Z2 with 14 tiles. It was super cool, so I showed it to Terry. And when we started to think, Curry, what he does, he constructs something that's aperiodic in Z2, but he gained the complexity by adding more tiles. Maybe if we don't restrict the dimension, maybe we can compensate for the number of the tiles. Maybe we can reduce the number of the tiles at the cost of enlarging the dimension. We will get the complexity from encoding this construction in high dimension. And we started to work on this encoding and developing this language, and we were not able to go beyond two. So we were able to get aperiodicity and undecidability with this encoding approach with two tiles, but we got stuck again. We were not able to go down to one. And then we went back to Z3 because, again, we had this obstacle. We thought that we should prove that it's true in Z3. So we thought that we looked at these groups, Z2 cross finite abelian group. And we thought, in Z2, we have a lot of information. We know exactly what happens in Z2. So let's try to use this information and prove a result about something that's almost Z2, Z2 cross finite abelian group. And if we were able to prove a result about Z2 cross G0 for any G0, maybe we can lift it to be a result in Z3. So we had a strategy. We had a strategy for proving the periodic tiling conjecture in Z2 cross G0. But the strategy failed because of the existence of such almost periodic function. So we couldn't proceed with our strategy. This was the obstacle. And then we thought, let's encode a puzzle that admits only such solutions that are that have this almost periodic behavior.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks. That's a great explanation. Okay, great. Well, in light of time, let's thank Rachel one more time for a wonderful talk.